Okay, first question about something.
Yeah.
I read in Speakeasy that when Weitsch left after this thing about the Christian, the religious implications, that you and Jamie Delano were supposed to be taking over, but you declined. You care to expand on that?
Okay, Rick was originally going to go up to, I think, about issue 94 of Swamp Thing, and Karen Berger had asked me if I'd take it over, and I'd said I'd love to, but I'm terrifyingly busy. Would I be prepared to do? I'm not prepared to take on another 12 issues a year, because quality is going to go down, so I'd be prepared to do it with Jamie. And Jamie had sort of tentatively agreed to that. And that was basically the overall plan, which was we'd sort of take it in turns on Swamp Thing. And then DC got silly. Rick did the story, which had called The Morning of the Magician, which had Swamp Thing meeting Jesus. And it's basically just Jesus sort of sitting in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then at the end he gets sort of shoved up onto a cross. And, I mean, it was really sweet. It was like one of these 1950s religious movies, you know, like The Robe or something. You know, John Wayne going, "Oh, surely that was the Son of God." And, it was really sweet. And DC suddenly had cold feet.
So there's been a lot of religious stuff going on in Hellblazer as well, isn't there?
Yeah, well, the thing is, this is what is so peculiar is, I think, I have this theory. My theory is that Rick's basic mistake was in asking everybody and sort of saying to people, you know, this is going to be contentious, this is okay, look, it's going to, you know. I think if he'd just done it, I mean, I've done it in this month's Swamp Thing annual, which I started to write, and I'd agreed to write before this thing blew up. Once it was blowing up just as I was writing this little 10-page story in the back. So I did I called the short story Shaggy God Stories, and it's about Jason Woodrow going down to the Parliament of Trees, lecturing his pet Venus flytrap, Milton, on the role of trees in comparative theology. And during the course of it, he manages to come out with things that would undoubtedly offend not only Muslims, but he describes the crucifixion in terms of cruelty to crowns of thorns and trees. Seeing that I didn't actually sort of wander around saying to everybody, look, I'm going to do stuff in here that's religious and contentious, does anybody mind? They just published it because they're not very bright. They're Americans. Whereas, if I'd have kicked up a fuss about it and said, look, I'm putting all this stuff through, does anybody mind? They would have gone, hell yes.
Yeah, they would have.
And so forth. On Swamp Thing, why I didn't take over? Three reasons. One, Rick is my friend. And I thought they were treating him very shoddily. Two, I thought that their actual grounds for rejecting that story and thus causing Rick to resign, because he really didn't have any other option, were very specious. And three, I wouldn't have been able to trust them at that point had I done Swamp Thing. I just tend to go off and write my stories, and if anybody, you know, and they get printed and so on and so forth. With Swamp Thing, I would have been worried at that point. I've been worried about trying to second guess them. You know, can I not do this because it would offend someone? Could I not do this because, you know, some right-wing jerk in redneck Missouri would think that it somehow offended his right to do something about it? You know, I mean, so that was basically it. Both myself and Jamie, following Rick's resignation, said, no, we won't do it. And a guy named Doug Wheeler is currently taking over, and I think Andy Helfer is going to do a few. And, you know, all power to them. I'd hate to see the title go down. It's a good comic, and I'm pleased with my little, it was a pleasure to write Swamp Thing in Black Orchid, and it was a pleasure to write all the subsidiary characters in the Parliament of Trees in my annual.
That's one thing that slightly worried me when I read that, even as you say that Andy Heppen might take over. So I was a bit worried that they might put someone like Paul Kupperberg or someone on it.
No. Karen knows...
what they're doing.
Yeah.
I'm just slightly worried.
You know, she knows it's a writer's book and she's going to put a writer on it. But, you know, Andy I think is doing a four-part story with Mike Mignola. And it's mainly this guy Doug Wheeler. I haven't seen any of his stuff. Karen says it's okay. So, we'll see.
Okay, what's this Books of Magic thing you're doing? I've seen little bits about that.
It's a four-part prestige thing.
Another prestige thing.
Prestige thing. DC phoned me up and said, okay, would you like to do a book that gives a sort of history of magic in the DC universe and a complete who's who to every magical character we've had that's also a readable story? And I said, what? Yeah, your minds. And I thought about it for a while. And then I thought of a story structure that will probably let me do it and let me do something fairly interesting in it. And I phoned back and said, yeah, all right, I'll do it. I'm doing book one. Each of the four books is being done with a different artist, which should be interesting. Book one's being done by John Bolton.
Good.
Books two and three are still in the balance. Different artists keep saying yes and then backing out because they discover they've got pressure work or whatever. Book four will be done by Paul Johnson, who did London Star.
Yeah.
Very beautiful stuff. And it's going to basically go all the way from the beginning of time to about half an hour before the end of time. And there's a story in there as well. It should be very strange. I mean, the stuff that I'm getting interested in is all the stuff that's nothing to do with the DC universe. Just sort of all these DC characters wiggling around on the fringes.
Yeah, well, Superman, Batman sort of thing.
Yeah, well, they are...
Getting away from that, but still keeping in the mass market.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, there's a level on which I've got an awful lot of what I came in to write DC for out of my system. You know, just the characters. I mean, I've now written pretty much every character I ever wanted to write. Having said that, admittedly, one story where I got a pile of characters in has never seen print and probably will never see print. So I did this story for what was meant to be the last issue of Action Comics Weekly. And it had sort of Superman, Green Lantern, the Phantom Stranger, Dead Man, Superman in Hell. I liked it. And just as it was about to be drawn, Mike Carlin, who was the Superman editor, freaked out and said, you've got Superman and Green Lantern knowing each other's secret identities in here, and they're old friends. And you can't do that because of the new continuity.
Yeah.
Can you rewrite it so they don't know each other? And I said, well, no, because it would make a nonsense of the story, which is about two old friends getting together, one of whom has problems, the other one doesn't. So I just said, you know, pull it and forget it. And that was what we did. We pulled it and forgot it.
On Black Orchid, what's going to happen now? Because you mentioned something about a female team a while back. I mean, do you have any control over the character?
I don't have any control over the character. She's like DC's character.
Do you like control over it? I mean, well, if they did something, would you like them to approach you?
I've said that I would much rather a female team took over because there hasn't been a strong female team in comics, in mainstream comics, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, there are very good female writers, good female artists, and very good female editors, but there's never been, nobody's ever put them all on the same book before. I'm very fond of the character. I did put my foot down on her going back into Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I know, so that would be...
Yeah, I said yeah. No. And I said, what? We were going to do the Baby Orchid, like the comic relief in Belle Reve. I said, no. You know, I've worked on this for 2 years. I really don't want you guys just sort of, you know, turning it into a comic relief. So they said, all right. I said, you can have Poison Ivy. And that left them happy. So Poison Ivy will go into Suicide Squad and Black Orchid won't. I don't know. I have another Black Orchid story, which takes place about 4 years after, 4 or 5 years after the one in Black Orchid, and it's called Black Orchard. And I don't know if I'll ever do it. I'd like to, but I wouldn't want to do it without either Dave McKean or an artist of Dave's caliber. And I don't think Dave ever wants to go back to Black Orchid. I mean, I think that Batman is... I think Arkham is going to be Dave's swan song. It's really the last... He has a much lower tolerance for superheroes than I did. And I think that after Arkham, Dave isn't going to go back to superheroes. So, don't know. I have a great deal of fondness for the character. I lived with her for a year and a half, as it were, and all the characters in there. And Black Orchid is a very, very strange story. It's sort of like an ecological invasion of the Body Snatchers, in which you get all the wrong people doing all the right things for all the right people doing all the wrong things for all the right motives. And it's, again, much more about Little Susie than it is about Orchid. But having said that, I mean, bear in mind, I don't own the character. I have no rights and no control over the character. If they made a Black Orchid movie tomorrow, I wouldn't see a penny from it, despite the fact that I put together, you know, a workable character from someone who was basically a cipher who hung around in DC limbo for 15 years. So, probably, I don't know, that's sort of very waffly, but it probably sort of answers your question.
Yeah. Do you mind that? I mean, like you said, you wouldn't collect any royalties from the film. I mean, do you feel that you should have rights to that, or do you feel that that's
With Black Orchid, not particularly, because I knew what I was doing when I went into it. With the idea with Black Orchid was very much this was the first thing that me and Dave had ever done. So we pitched them a DC character, and admittedly we turned her into something totally new, but we knew that, you know, we figured we had a better chance of getting into print. You know, all we'd done when we were closing the deal on Black Orchid was we were halfway through Violent Cases. You know, we weren't exactly... We didn't have any kind of reputation. We were two people that nobody had ever heard of. So no, I mean, it doesn't rank on that.
I've noticed quite a lot of appearance of superheroes and supervillains in a lot of your work. I mean, is this quite a deep love for you?
Part of it's nostalgia. Part of it's a fondness for... I mean, you know, God, when I was sitting there plotting Black Orchid, I thought, I'll do Batman, come on! You know, I mean, this is me, I get the right Batman, wow! That was terrific. And I've had a nice time in Sandman, the little JLA thing was fun. I mean, Scott Free's dreams and the demon, Constantine, of course, who's a lovely character, he writes himself. All these bizarro characters in the old DC mystery books. But I think with the exception of the characters in the DC mystery books cropping up again, because they're basically now Sandman territory, and a complete and utter resolution of the 1970s Sandman problem, that's probably about it in Sandman. I'm not saying that we'll never see another superhero or another supervillain in Sandman. But I am saying that what I wanted to do with Sandman was spend the first half dozen issues almost just sort of setting the groundwork for people in terms of who this character is, where he fits into the DC universe. So we're now at a point where everybody has a pretty good idea of who he is, where he fits in with relationships to pretty much everybody else.
You established this character now.
Yeah, he is
from nothing to.
Yeah, exactly. You know who he is. You know what he's doing. We have a fair idea of what he's doing. You have an idea of, for example, I mean, we haven't introduced Superman or Batman or any of these characters into the book, but you know roughly where he is in relation to them, and so forth. So. There's no real need for them anymore. Which again is not to say that we aren't going to see any DC characters, but we're going to spend a lot more time with the Sandman's family, the Sandman's history.
Death.
We're going to meet Death, we're going to meet Desire, we're going to meet Despair. Around issue 17 we're going to meet Destruction, who quit about 300 years ago and has gone off and alternately worked as a mercenary and as an artist. You know, there's quite a few very strange characters to come up, and we're going to stick within those parameters for a while. And then, but the nice thing about Sandman is, if I need a DC character, I can always drag them in. I love doing the Scarecrow in issue 5, and he crops up again in issue 7 in Arkham. He was the guy hanging.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
He's a lovely character to write. Just nice speech patterns.
How far do you plan ahead with the Sandman? You mentioned issue 17.
Okay, I planned, when I started it, I planned up to number 8. So from the point where I started writing it, I knew what was happening roughly in each issue up to number 8. I mean, actually, I had a better idea of what happened in number 8 than I did in 5, 6, and 7. 5, 6, and 7 were just sort of a bit of a blur, but I knew the shape of them. By the time I got to about issue 7, I had a fairly good idea of what was happening in issues 10 through to about 16. I've now written issue 10, and I know exactly what's going to happen in issues 10 through to 16.
How do you actually go about writing a script? I mean, this is one thing I've always wondered, because...
Here's...
How do you go from a load of ideas to an actual script?
Page 1. I sit down and I start typing and I say, okay, Richard, page 1. We've got 6 panels on the page of roughly similar size. Panel 1, we're inside a cupboard and we're looking out, and we can see Chester leaning over and, you know, what's her name behind him? And we've got no name.
Well, it's,
I believe
this. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Liz.
Chester and Liz, thank you. Liz standing behind him, and we can see all this garbage. Over on one side is a big raggy doll. You know, this, that, and the other. Caption, there was a man who tried to do more good than bad, born out of his time. Chester, boy, I haven't looked at this stuff since we moved in. Do you really think it could be worth money? That's basically where you start, you know. And then writing them all, you know, page 2. Okay, splash page, you can see Chester's hands holding a poster, and on the poster is Brother Power the Geek, and this is what he looks like. Spent about a page describing him, and, you know, on the poster is written in sort of psychedelic lettering, we're doing our own thing, and we're sending it to Congress, vote Brother Power for Flower Power.
Chester off. This is something on you.
Chester off, whatever happened to him, you know, title at the bottom, Brothers. You know, so it's sort of credits.
So
that's basically how I write it.
So you get an idea sorted out in your head, you work out what's going to happen in the whole story, and then you sit your word processor and get
sit
it out.
My word processor and write it. Sometimes things happen that surprise me, sometimes they don't.
Mm.
Sometimes I'll go off and write it panel by panel. Sometimes I'll wind up writing a chunk of a couple of pages of dialogue, and then have to break it down into panels. Sometimes I'll wind up writing the panels and then go back and have to sort of dialogue them through once I've written, know what happens and what people are doing.
Do you ever sort of, you sit down, you get halfway through and think, you sort of immediately start changing your ideas because something just sort of comes in, oh, this might be good.
Yes. Yes, that happens too. I just started, like on Sandman 10, when I got to, I'd known a few very minor things about one of the characters who I'm going to be introducing in Sandman 10. When I got to about page 15, and you just see him for a panel, I suddenly discovered while I was writing the panel description what he looked like, and who he was. He was called the Corinthian. He's an escape nightmare. He's sort of living a real life, or pretending to live a real life, as a human being, as a serial killer. And I still didn't really know how that one was going to end, which is unusual, because normally I have a fairly good idea of what's on the last page. Even if I don't have an idea of anything else, I know what I'm heading for. and I got to the last page of number 10, and I wound up writing a page from the Corinthians' viewpoint. And that sort of changed, modified, and I hope improved what's going to be happening through issues 12, 13, 14, and 15. And also gives a link to them, because we're going to see an awful lot, 11 to about 14, because we're going to see a lot more of the Corinthian, or a lot more from his viewpoint. And he's just going to wind up holding a lot of apparently very disconnected stuff together.
When you write a script, do you bear the artist in mind?
Yeah.
David Keane.
I write it for the artist. I mean, some artists do one thing, some do another. You know, Dave McKean, you know, if I'm right, I mean, the fun thing about writing, this was written for Richard Rayner. Now, I know what Richard does, and Richard loves doing, you know, tiny, noodly bits of detail and so on and so forth. So I can say to, you know, I can start listing all the things that I want to see in the panel and so forth, and know that, you know, I'm going to get the copies of Green Lantern and the Enterprise and the Lost in Space robot build-it-yourself model kit, and it's all going to be in there, and it's all going to be visible.
Whereas Dave would have just a blur of colour, which...
Yeah, well, Dave, I wouldn't...
You'd have... You just leave it up to him, really, just say, right, I want black orchid here, and he basically...
Yeah, I mean, with Dave, I tend to write things that resemble film scripts. Mm. I mean, with Dave, I rarely break things down into panels. Just because he has a better design sense than I have. He has a better design sense than anybody else I know, with the possible exception of Bill Sienkiewicz. So it's sort of like, why even try to impose an order on him that doesn't give him free rein? I'd much rather see him do what he's best at.
Have you ever done anything with Bill Sienkiewicz?
No, we're meant to, one day.
You were credited in
Elektra.
No, yeah,
that was a joke.
I mean, you...
We're going... One day we plan to do a book together called Obsessional, which is all about the entire population of New York marching into the sea.
Yes.
Which is...
Perfect reason.
Yes. It should be fun. But it's really for both of us just a matter of the time. And we're friends, and I love his stuff, and he likes mine. You know, it's sort of... Bill is one of the people, you know, whose work excites me, and there aren't an awful lot of those around.
Why do you think comics like Hellblazer and Sandman are so popular? I mean, what...
People are sick. People
are
sick. They're sick! I don't know what it is! I mean, sick!
Martial law and stuff, you get martial law outselling X-Men in Britain. I mean, what is it? Is it just...
I don't know.
Violence or... that's when I got into it. I mean, when I started getting comics, I thought, wow, violence and stuff. And then I grew up a little bit, and I thought, yeah, I mean, this is a lot better because it's deep, because it thinks. I think
it's the thinking. I think it's the fact that with an awful lot of American comics, I'm talking here about American mainstream comics, not necessarily American
Superman.
Independent stuff.
Yeah. Superman, Green Lantern, that sort of stuff.
Most of the American mainstream. You feel that it's being written without anybody ever engaging a brain, you know, sort of. It's just sort of, and you know, one thing that you can say about Jamie's stuff or my stuff or Grant Morrison's stuff or Pat Mills' stuff is there is very obviously a mind behind it, and also they're obviously written by Alan Moore, of course, to go back to the man who started it all. They're very obviously written by the people they're written by. You know, Jamie's version of Sandman will be a totally different creature.
I notice he's appeared in every single DC horror book now. Sandman, Hellblazer.
This is true.
Well, he's met them all.
Hasn't met the Spectre, because I don't like.
Never appealed to me.
Dull. I like the character, but I don't know what they're doing with him. So he hasn't met the Spectre. Or Dr. Fate, because, you know, it's the wrong sort of book. But basically, you can tell that we're writing them. I mean, I admire Animal Man, but I couldn't write it. You know, that's very much what Grant does best. Yeah, exactly. It's a different kind of thing to what I'm doing. And Sandman, I'm incredibly... What's the best word for this? Flabbergasted, probably. It's something up from astonished. how well it's doing, and how popular it is, and how much of a cult book it's become. Because I figured that Sandman was almost going to be the equivalent of a private little comic. You know, I'd just sort of do it, and it would sell its 40,000 or whatever, and that would be that. And it would just sort of be a place to experiment. You know, I got a phone call recently from Dave McKean to say that in his local Phantom, his local shop, Comic Zone in Reading, it's, you know, outselling everything except Excalibur. Which I never expected. I just sort of figured it was going to be my own little peculiar thing. And I figured there have got to be other people out there as strange as I am.
Well, I think it's been helped by Hellblazer.
Hellblazer's popular. I mean, I'm doing an issue of Hellblazer. Jamie's going to go on holiday for about 4 months. He does. And I'm going to do one, which is all about dead tramps, which should be quite fun. About sort of, I've got it about half written already. It's about 3 or 4 Hellblazers up the line, I suppose.
Okay. Final question, I think. If you had the power, how would you change or improve the comic industry today? What would you do?
What would I do? I'd do a number of things. The most important thing that I'd do is run it a lot more like a book publisher, which involves just giving the creators a larger chunk of the cake.
Yeah.
I know. Rather than the occasional sort of little crumbs. I mean, you know, something like, you know, when you look at something like 2000 AD, 2000 AD is in the fucking dark ages. You know, I mean, I noticed recently that, you know, Quality had reprinted a couple of crappy Future Shocks I did for 2000 AD.
Yeah.
Now, fair enough, I don't see any more money from that. I have no control over the fact that it appears in that horrible Quality Comics format that is stretched on Xerox and coloured by crayon. You know, they don't give creators royalties, and they wonder why all the good talent goes to America. But having said that, even American comic companies don't run like, generally speaking, don't run like book companies. And I also don't necessarily think that the comic, per se, is necessarily the best way of publishing comics. Which may sound, I mean, that's one reason why we've done this thing for The Face. We're just going to run it in The Face. You know, now, whether or not it proves a pointlessly elaborate experiment that makes us both look stupid, or whether it falls flat in its face, or whatever, the fact of the matter is we're doing
a comic format in a magazine.
A comic in a magazine, which is about other things. It's going to run about 6 pages in this issue. It'll run about 4 pages a month for about 6 or 7 months, and then we'll finish it off with another 6-page issue.
Is that Dave McKean?
That's Dave. Who else? And at the end of that time, we'll have a 40-odd page story called Signal to Noise, which we'll own. And if we want to publish it, you know, ourselves, or sell it to a publisher or whatever, to bring out as a book, then fine. But we'll have control over that. We own more than just the characters. We own the cake.
Yeah, it's all yours.
It's all ours. And I like that way of doing things. I think it's a good way of doing things. I think it's sensible. Because at the end of the day, character created stuff has value. I'm not arguing with that. But I do think that in order to get top quality creative talents, you know, good writers, good artists, the kind of artists and writers who work in the mainstream, into comics, you're going to have to offer them more than, you know, the chance to write Green Lantern for 6 issues. Maybe Piranha Press, the DC thing, is going to be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, actually.
I'm looking forward to that. I think that the fact that a lot of British publishers are currently very interested in getting into comics, I think the fact that you've got things like Dark Knight or Watchmen or whatever collected up in book form, is a major step in the right direction, because it adds permanence.
They're being sold in bookshops all over.
Exactly.
Show it news, got their own comics. It's not selling well, but...
Well, that's the way it ought to be, you know. I mean, not they're not selling well, but the fact that they're out there. Because otherwise it becomes an incestuous little business, rather than something that actually gets out into the big wide world. You know, comics is a medium as valid.
The problem, I think, with comics, I mean, unless you know that someone at FanZone exists, or you've seen the comics in Shirt News, you're just going to think that it's bottom rack of... bottom rack of Dwight Smith.
which is why we need things like, you know, the Dark Knight book, the Watchmen book, which is why we need, you know, mainstream publishers, where we need book collections.
The only thing that really gets me as a crisis is right next to My Little Pony.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Should be up on the top shelf, really. Oh. So somebody's going to complain about it soon, and just going to take it.
Sure. Well, not. I mean, we'll wait and see what happens with crisis. But it is... You know, comics, we're in a period of change. So I'm not necessarily sure it's sort of what I'm quite happy to just sort of keep on doing whatever it is that I'm doing and watch what happens, because I think we're in a world that's changing anyway. Yeah, it's going to be exciting to see what happens next.
Yeah, just one thing about prestige format. When you do the Poison Ivy Zoology in standard format and Black Orchids in prestige, do you get the same money for that? Or because
I get more money for the prestige.
Yeah, also.
You know, I get more money up front, and I get more money because I'm going to get royalties. Mm. You know, I mean, I'm on something like a 4% royalty from Black Orchid.
4%.
Which isn't an awful lot, but it does mean that every, you know, £2 you spend, 8 pennies of that goes to me. Mm. That's right, maths is never my strongest subject. But, so just on that basis, yes, I get paid more for that, but... paid more for Black Orchid than I did for Sandman. Although Sandman's gradually sort of, you know, every issue it sells more and more copies, so the royalties are sort of climbing, which is nice.
Will we be seeing a graphic novel of Sandman?
Titan Books want to collect Sandman. Yes, I mean, they want to do, like the, I don't know if you've seen the Hellblazer books they're doing.
Yes.
They want to do that with Sandman. And I know DC would like me to do a prestige format, you know, two-part Sandman story or something, which I might do, I might not, I don't know.
Would you be looking at David Keith, the artist, for that sort of thing?
Well, Sandman originally started as one of the germ points for Sandman was what me and Dave were going to do after Black Orchid. And Black Orchid had been so realistic and so panel, pocket-a-pocket-a-pocket-a, 6 panels a page, very, very grounded in the real world. I thought it would be nice to do something that's totally away from that, which is why I originally thought of just doing something that was entirely set in dreams, which was where one of the germinal points of Sandman.
I like the arts you've got on that. I mean, some people complain that it's messy and it's difficult to read, but I mean, I like that. I think it suits the story. But if, I mean, if you had someone like George Perry on, it'd ruin it.
Well, I like the new art. I mean, the new art team on number 6, I'm actually a little happier with than I was with... I like what Sam did, but it was limiting in terms of the kind of stories I could write. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have done... Have you read number 6 yet?
Yeah.
Okay, I couldn't have written that with Sam on the art, because Sam couldn't have created 6 believable people for me to put through hell. Yeah. Just because, you know, just the difference between the two artists. Whereas, you know, Mike is very, very strong at the realistic stuff. He's probably weaker on the dead weird.
Head chopping off.
Yeah, the kind of stuff that Sam was very good at. Mm. So you win some, you lose some. And I think Dave's done me proud on the covers.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I love those covers. I still can't work out how he does it. I mean,
you want to know how he does it?
Yes.
They're about 3 feet high. He builds shelves down the side. He puts things on the shelves. He paints the painting in the middle. And then he photographs it. And sends the transparency off to DC. So he does it.
Does he always do that? Because, I mean, I think it was in number 4, or number 3, the one where it's hell. But they had the fire burning through it. I mean, is that...
That's a trade secret. That you really want to know how he did that?
Yeah.
Okay. he took a photograph. He set light to a piece of paper, photographed the piece of paper burning, and then stuck down a photo of the burning paper onto the burning piece of paper on the cover.
I was just wondering how it does.
Yes. It's very fitting.
We have an exclusive here.
On Sandman 4, the one with the demon, with Lucifer on the cover, he was planning to set light to the whole thing. So it was all just going to be burnt. But he tried that and it didn't work properly because it just sort of went black. So instead he burnt out bits of it and stuff.
It's really good. I mean, it's better than Tailbirds and stuff.
I think so, but because we sat down at the beginning on Sandman number 1. And we planned out what was going to be on the cover of each. We decided, you know. I mean, the thing is, Hellblazer covers have to have Constantine on, and they're not actually, they were never conceived of as a series. Whereas Sandman covers, we just said, right, we'll do a portrait gallery. You know, I phoned up Karen Berger and said, okay, the Sandman is on the cover of number 1.
That's it.
But he's not going to be on the covers of any of those. But she was going, well, how will they know this is Sandman then? I'll say it's got Sandman written on the top. They'll look it out, trust them, they're smarter than you give them credit for. You know, you don't have to put the lead character on the cover, really, trust me. And she went, well, alright. And I'm sure the Sandman will crop up again on another cover, eventually, but probably in the Doll's House storyline, which are like the, you know, they're a new series of covers. And again, there's a totally different design.
Still dead.
Yep. But we're redesigning the cover. I mean, now that people are used to this cover design, and now I see from Aquaman they've started ripping us off.
Yeah, I know.
You know, that's fine, because we've already worked out what the new set of covers are going to be like. You know, it's going to be a totally new design.
Is there any symbolism behind the shelves at all? Is it just, why not shelves?
I think it was more like why not shelves. It was also a way of cramming a lot of things in, which gave resonance. And what we didn't want to do was take a scene from Sandman, or, you know, take an image from the story and then blow it up.
Yeah.
What we wanted to do was just take a character and stick them on the cover. But then we wanted to get some of the other stuff in. So the shelves were an ideal way of doing that.
Who's on the cover of 6? Two hands.
That's meant to be Dr. Destiny.
That's Dr. Destiny.
Yes, okay. But you can't really see very much more than the hands than the eye.
It's all a slant skull.
Yes.
But on 5, who's the face and the wires?
The face and the wire is meant to be the sort of 6-year-old Godfrey.
Ah,
of course.
Yeah. Right.
Number 7 is very strange, even though I'm not sure who's going to be on the cover of number 7. It's either the Sandman or it's Dr. D, or possibly both. Number 8 is definitely Death. Number 9, I think, is going to be a load of sand, but I haven't seen it yet. Yes, no.
Okay,
I think
that's all right.
Great.
That's all right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for that.
My pleasure.
Do you want us to send you a copy at all?
Yes, send us a copy. Do you want an address?
Yeah, we'll say it.
Okay, it's number 4, Little Mead, LITTLEMEAD, that's all one word, Nutley, NUTLEY, East Sussex, TN223LP, that's P for pneumonia.
Okay.
There you go.
Thanks very much. Sure. Mr. Bayman, cheerio.